It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Doug Gordon, filling in for Anne Strainchamps. When she was younger, journalist Arielle Levy learned how to conquer her fear.
The way that I dealt with fear is to sort of hurl myself at things that scared me. The first time I really did it was when I was young and I'd never traveled. I'd never seen the world at all. And I just thought, okay, I want to be the kind of woman who would go to India by herself. And so I did. And I was really scared, but I wanted to be the kind of person who would do that. So I just thought, well, I'll start doing things like that and then maybe I'll be that kind of person.
That ability to leap headfirst into the unknown helped shape Arielle into a fearless and intrepid journalist. The kind of person who wouldn't think twice about traveling halfway across the globe in pursuit of a good story. And it earned her the respect of her peers, first at New York Magazine, and then at The New Yorker. But a few years ago, in her late 30s, Arielle Levy embarked on an entirely new pursuit, motherhood.
What happened was that I got pregnant, and I was thrilled. And I just thought, this is the most exciting thing in the world. I mean, I would just go to sleep every night and be like, I have a baby in me. And when I was 5 months pregnant, I got an assignment to write about the impending transformation of the economy in Mongolia and what that was going to mean for women. My doctor told me it was fine to fly up until the third trimester. And I wasn't really, you know, concerned about it. I mean, I sort of thought, I think I kind of liked the idea of being the kind of woman who would go do a story in Mongolia pregnant, the same way I'd like the idea of being the kind of girl who would go to India by herself. And I was not scared. But the second night I was there, I went into labor in my hotel room and I gave birth. You know, for 10 minutes, I was somebody's mother. And then the baby died before the ambulance came, which would have happened anywhere. You know, when I got back from Mongolia, I was so sad I could barely breathe. At the time, I felt an oceanic sense of guilt. I mean, I just thought that I had sort of boarded this plane out of selfishness and vanity and that I had been punished for it. You feel insane. I mean, the amount of pain you feel when you lose, I don't know what else to call it, a baby. I mean, you know, I think there's this idea, it's just a miscarriage. And I mean, I think I have a particularly dramatic story because I had a living person come out of my body who I was with for 10 minutes while he was alive and moving. I mean, there's no one who can tell me that that was just a miscarriage and it's not a big deal. When you see your baby moving in your hand, that's a big deal. You feel like you're overreacting. You feel like, am I insane? Like, is it inappropriate in some way that I have this level of anguish?
Arielle Levy chronicles that trip to Mongolia in her memoir, The Rules Do Not Apply. She spoke to Raymond Tungekar about the emotional fallout of losing her son. She started by talking about her decision to take a photograph of her son during the few minutes he was alive.
Oh, thank God. Thank God I did that. Oh, I can't imagine what life would be like if I hadn't done that. You know, I needed it. I mean, I knew at that moment, I knew this is it. Like, this is all the time I'm going to get with this guy because obviously, he's not going to live. I mean, I knew. I'm not crazy. I mean, I knew it was not going to be okay. And I just thought, I'm going to want to see his face again. And God knows I did. I mean, I can't imagine how much time. I can begin to calculate how much time I spent looking at that picture after I got back that first year.
I mean, if you don't mind me asking, is there a particular thing that you treasure most about that brief time that you were a mother?
Well, I experienced maternal love, which there's no coming back from that. You know, once you experience that rawest, most primal, that feeling where you just think, yeah, I would obviously, without even thinking, if I was given the choice, like, one of us is going to die, obviously I'd be like, oh, I'll do it. I mean, that feel, I had never felt anything like that before.
Did you think that actually existed before this happened?
I think I was afraid, you know, as I think it's not that uncommon. I think I was afraid, what if I'm not capable of that feeling? You know, what if I'm so selfish that I have a kid and and that never kicks in and I'm just a horrible mother? I think that was one of the reasons I didn't start, you know, until it was, as it turns out for me, too late. Because I was scared. I was scared I didn't have the right constitution to be a mother. And, you know, and it's the great sadness of my life that I learned, oh, I do have that constitution, but I learned it right as I was losing it. And as it turned out, that was it. I could never get pregnant again. You know, I tried for years and I gave it everything I had to give until eventually it was like, this is just not what's going to happen. And then I had to accept that, you know.
Mm-hmm. You alluded to this earlier, but you talk about how, you know, you felt this, I mean, as is the case with a lot of people who are grieving, some of that grief gets turned inward and, you know, manifests as blame or guilt. Do you still feel a sense of responsibility or any remaining guilt?
Not about the baby. I mean, my marriage also ended right then, and I still feel guilty about that. But and I still feel responsibility for that, which is appropriate because I'm half of what went wrong. You know what I mean? Like, who else? I mean, both of us are responsible. You know, so of course I feel some guilt and some responsibility, as I should. For the baby, no, though. I've heard enough now. I've learned enough from I believe in science. You know,
mm-hmm.
And you know, since then I've spoken to enough medical professionals who have explained to me, no, that's not how it works. You know, a placental abruption, which is what I had, that was going to happen wherever you were. That doesn't happen because you get on an airplane.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm not sure if this is accurate, but I imagine another component of the grief you might have felt, I mean, I imagine it might have involved losing a lost possible self.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
How did you end up reaching a place of acceptance after losing such a cherished part of your identity?
Yeah, it was harsh. It was not pretty. It was really, really harsh. You know, when I got back, my overwhelming experience was, this is not acceptable. I do not accept this. This is a crime against nature that my son is dead. And I don't accept it. I don't accept that. I don't accept that my spouse is an alcoholic. None of this is acceptable to me. And, you know, over time, it became clear to me, you can accept it or not, but this is reality. What are you going to do with it? And one of the places I really sort of got introduced to that notion was in Al-Anon. You know, eventually, I had been sort of snotty about the whole thing for a long time and just, I don't want to deal with that. And then when I went, I felt that concept of things are as they are, and you can make a case about why they're unfair or why they are horrible, but there they are. What are you going to do with that information? And you're responsible for what you do. That was sort of revelatory to me. And that is very different than you're in control. I mean, it's like kind of the opposite of you're in control. And I think that as a writer, you become accustomed to this experience of authorial control, where you can sort of tinker with a narrative. I mean, even if you're a nonfiction writer, as I am, your building blocks are true, and a fact checker checks them at The New Yorker and at most places, you know, to make sure that you've got your data right. But the way you combine them, the way you decide to tell the story, is up to you. And I learned that that was not applicable to life, and that the skill set that had served me as a writer was not serving me as a human, and that I had to surrender. And that's what I've done.
Hmm. Well, and that kind of gets at one of the central tensions of the book. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this conflict between the idea that we have agency contrasted against the idea that we're kind of at the whims of nature and circumstance.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering if that realization that you weren't in complete control, did that come as a relief or did that feel like resignation?
Well, not initially, but now I've learned to like aspects of it a lot. Yeah. Not initially, but mm-hmm. but now, yeah, I think there's a liberation in sort of saying, okay, you know, it doesn't matter how badly you want to be a mother. It doesn't mean you get to. It doesn't mean this is going to happen. You know, and I think part of the way that I've surrendered is by thinking, okay, well, what do I have? And a lot of it's great, you know? I mean, you'd be crazy if you weren't grateful for my life, you know? I mean, it's a great life.
And, you know, of course, there are still things that you are in control of. I understand you fell in love again?
Yeah.
And are soon to be married or current?
Well, I don't know about soon, but we'll deal with it eventually.
Oh, sorry. Sorry to jump the gun.
No. It's not for any reason other than, like, immigration complexities. Yeah, and now talk about something where you need to surrender. I mean, my doctor and I fell in love. The doctor who I met in the clinic in Mongolia, who is not Mongolian, he's from South Africa. Originally, actually, he's from what is now Zimbabwe, but he'd been living in South Africa for a long time, became sort of my pen pal. When I got back to the United States, he had sent me like a medical report that I needed for insurance. And believe it or not, my doctor in New York was not getting back to me. Like, I had called the office, and the receptionist, I told her what happened, and she burst into tears, which I liked. I mean, I just felt like that was the appropriate response. But then the doctor never called me back, so I was furious about that. And then this other doctor who I had met, you know, on the craziest night of my life, and who was the only person who had seen me as a mother with her child who had died, he had sent me this thing, and I had said to him, is it normal that I'm lactating? I mean, I didn't know. And he explained to me, you know, the oxytocin letdown that signals the body to have contractions also signals the milk letdown reflex. But the way he put it was, it's one of nature's less kind tricks. And I just thought that was such a beautiful way to put it. And we started writing. And, you know, we became pen pals. And then eventually we fell in love. So, you know what is impractical? Falling in love with someone when you live in New York who works in Mongolia and lives in South Africa. That is impractical. But we, you know what? I'll be darned. I mean, we got it together.
Ariel, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Ariel Levy is the author of The Rules Do Not Apply. She talked with Raymond Tungekar.